BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dillis Powell, Frank Muir, Ann Scott James, and Dennis Norton. Here's round one to test their vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words roughly right. Dillis Powell, what is the meaning of brevi caudate? B-R-E-V-I-C-A-U-D-A-T-E.
Brevi?
B-R-E. Brevi caudate.
B-R-E-V-I-C-A-U.
Yes.
Short-tailed.
Absolutely right. 2 marks straight away. Having a short tail, or I suppose, in the case of certain dogs, docked. Dennis Norton, what is a jackaroo? Jack like Jack and A-R-O-O, jackaroo.
Australian word?
Hmm.
Yeah. Looks like a device for changing the tyres on a kangaroo. But I doubt it, because they don't have tyres.
You're quite right.
They have tyre pockets, but they don't have tyres.
Mm. Half out of two for the Australian bit.
Half out of two?
It's Australian...
Charity, then.
It's Australian slang for a new chum, a young Englishman learning sheep or cattle farming for the first time. It's probably a portmanteau word of Jack and kangaroo, but it may come from an Aborigine, rather sort of nasty name for any white man. Jackaroo. Ann Scott James, what is an ephemera? E-P-H-E-M-E-R-A, ephemera.
Well, it's something which only lasts a day.
Exactly.
Was that do?
Not quite. I want to know what it is.
Well, I should think it's probably some sort of butterfly or moth or something of that sort. They're the ephemeridae, aren't they?
That's right. But well, they're not normally butterflies or moths, quite. Think of what dances on the water when the trout fishermen are trying in May.
Oh, yes, exactly. Mayfly.
1.5.
1.5?
I give you quite a lot of help. An ephemera is an insect that in its final stage, what's called the imago, the thing with wings, lasts only for a day, or the genus of insects, which in fact includes the mayfly, and it can from that mean anything which lives rather a short time. Frank Muir, and I don't mean the slang, what is necking?
There's slang involved. Necking is a form of passionate encounter between the sexes, rather like driving with one foot on the accelerator and the other on the brake. slang words, I don't know. I just use a plain one.
Translate this into stone.
Architect.
Statue.
Yes, an architecture.
Architectural term.
Oh, yes. Necking is a term in architecture.
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
It's,
necking, in its straightforward rather than its slang sense, an architectural term defining that part of a column or a pillar between the shaft and the capital that goes above it, joins the two. Before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and the two women members of the teams will, I hope, go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the programme I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is et tu brute, and Ann Scott James and Dennis, yours is it never rains but it pours. And then at the end of the programme I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Round two is about verse and poetry. What I do is to give each team a line or two and ask them to complete it. 2 marks if they can complete the quotation, and 2 more for naming author and poem. We begin with Dillis Powell. So little cause for carolings of such ecstatic sound was written on terrestrial things afar or nigh around that I could think there trembled through his happy good-night air. Probably on a heath.
On a heath?
A large heath.
Hardy.
Yes.
Hardy. Hardy.
Helped a bit.
Hardy Heath.
You don't know what creature he is writing about here.
A lark.
It's Thomas Hardy, the darkling thrush. A thrush rather than a lark. And it finishes off, that I could think there trembled through his happy good-night air some blessed hope, whereof he knew and I was unaware. Dennis Norden. She only said, my life is dreary. He cometh not, she said.
And I would that I were dead.
That's right. And who
it's
and...
It's Marianne of the Moated Grange.
By?
Tennyson.
Jolly good. Anne Scott James. I made a garland for her head, and bracelets too, and fragrant zone.
Is that Keats?
Hmm?
It's the Belle Dame sans Merci.
Yep.
Now, can you read it again while we try and guess the next
line? I made a garland for her head, and bracelets too, and fragrant zone.
Throne?
No. I made a garland for her head, and bracelets too, and fragrant zone. She looked at me as she did love, and made sweet moan. Frank Muir. Breathes there a man with soul so dead, who never to himself hath said.
This is my home, my native land, whose heart has ne'er within him turned, spurned, as home his footsteps he hath turned, from wandering in a foreign strand, if such there be. Go! Mark him well, for him no minstrel's raptures swell, high though his station, proud his name, boundless his wealth, as wish can claim. Despite his titles, power and pelf, this rich, consented all in self, living shall forfeit all renown, and double dying shall go down to the vile earth from which he sprung, unwept, unhonored, and unsung.
Can mine be a very mild voice asking author?
He made it
up. Just heard a reading loosely of Sir Walter Scott's The Patriot.
Yes, absolutely. 4 marks it is. Sir Walter Scott, The Patriot, it comes from The Lay of the Last Minstrel. And that was perfectly splendidly rendered. Well, now we have a round of origins and derivations, and 3 marks are available. If members of the team can define the present meaning, first of all, and then give me the origin and derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. We begin with Dillis Powell. Indentures.
Indentures?
Indentures are...
kind of apprenticeship,
yeah,
isn't it?
Agreement between them.
Yes. You agree to work for a certain time.
That's what it is, but why is it called indenture?
Well, I don't know. It means sort of in and out.
It's quite literal.
In and out.
It's quite literal, it is.
Dimply paper, which Americans use for airmail.
Yes, stick to that. Frank, it is the paper on which it's written. You've got nearly there.
The paper's got dimples.
All right, 2 out of 3. That's fairly generous. Indentures are a written and usually sealed contract, and nearly always it's a contract between an apprentice and his master. But they were called indentures for a quite literal reason, because you had 2 identical documents and you tore them on a zigzag line down the middle so that only those 2 papers in the whole world would fit together. And that meant that neither side could argue that the contract didn't exist, because you've got the perfect other half, rather like breaking a sixpence as a love token so that the bits fitted together. 2 marks out of 3, I think, is about right. Dennis Norden, hack writers.
And I'll have no cracks from you.
Charming.
It was addressed to me, yes. Yeah. Hack writers are, what would you say? I'm trying to avoid the word journalist, Anne. Are writers who write regularly for money.
Yes.
Which embraces a fair percentage of us. Hack, because a hack was a horse that was hired out.
Yes.
And Presumably they likened the writer. They, in fact, today they still talk. Comedians say, well, I have a stable of writers. Okay. And they compared the writer to a hired horse.
Yes, I think that's it. Thank you, Mitchell. Three marks. Well
it
done.
It is very untrue because there's very little heavy lifting.
I think Dennis has got there. Hack is short for Hackney, and from quite an early stage on, 14th century on, name given to a class of rather smallish horses, distinguishing them from very large horses like plough horses or war horses. And they were used for ordinary riding and usually for a horse that was let out for hire, as Dennis said. And so it came to mean anyone who hired out his services, and a Hackney writer was a poor literary drudge, often furbishing other people's works. And Scott James, slaves.
Well, it means those who work perforce. Mm-hmm. And are just pushed around by thug employers.
And belong to?
Masters.
Mm. And why? Why does slave come to mean this?
Does it come from Slavs?
Yes.
I should think the Slavs were the slaves of the Russians.
I'll go back a bit earlier.
Oh, older than that.
Romans.
The Romans. Well, the Slavs were one. Well, the Romans had brought slaves from all over the place, but I suppose the best slaves, or the most desirable ones, came from Slavland.
Yes, 2.5, I think, because I gave a bit of help. The Slavi were tribes who lived on the banks, as went entirely surprise you, of the River Dnieper, and the word Slav originally meant something quite different, meaning noble or illustrious, but as Anne rightly said, they became well known as slaves to the Romans in the later stages of the Roman Empire, and they were all over Europe as slaves in that way. Frank Moore, cravat.
Well, now we're back to nicking. Cravat is a type of nicking. In other words, something that you hang around your neck.
Yes.
It's a slightly larger and many cases more complicated tie.
Yes.
French word.
Yes.
Cravat.
Yeah. Not unlike the Slavs again. Serbo something.
Cravat.
Yes.
Well, they were originally invented by Croats.
Mm. As Frank says, a type of neckwear which is considerably more elaborate than a tie and usually ended in a bow, now in various forms coming back into fashion. But they were first introduced into France in the 17th century by the Croatian soldiers. It was part of their uniform, and the French rather liked it. And the French then formed a regiment of soldiers who wore this particular kind of neckwear, and they were known as the Royal Cravat Regiment. But it comes from Croatia. And now we come to the last round, and go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks to this power, can you give me the origin of your quotation, Et tu, Brute?
The last words of Julius Caesar.
In
Julius Caesar. By William Shakespeare.
In Rome.
During his murder.
Absolutely right. 2 marks. Well done. Anne Scott James, I'd like the origin of your quotation, It never rains, but it pours.
Well, I think this is rather more lowly, less lofty. I think it's a proverb.
Mm-hmm. What sort of century do you find it coming?
Oh, well, sort of 18th century,
yes,
it's a good time for proverbs.
Well done. 2 marks. And now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir and his quotation, Et tu, Brute.
Very odd, you know, because this line was written on the back of an envelope tucked into my middle poodle's collar while I was in the kitchen. And really, to tell you how this came about, I must reveal, and I want to reveal, the truth about the new parish priest, Father Burke, of the parish priest of Egham Hythe, Surrey, and the affair of the maids of honour. It goes back about a fortnight, and my wife had invited Father Burke to the house to come and meet us. Now, Establish that fact in your mind, because that's where the whole ghastly business started. That Father Burke proceeded on his way to our house. Right. Now, at the same time, I was coping with a problem. Our middle poodle, his name is Puddle, for self-evident reasons, when she was younger, was on heat. This raises certain difficulties with giving them sort of exercise. So I thought, well, the only way to do this is to make sure that she gets air. And so I got a plastic bucket and the clothesline, tied the clothesline stoutly to the handle, put the poodle in the bucket and started swinging it round my head. Then by paying out the cord, I got it sweeping round in about a 30-foot circle, and the centrifugal force kept her in the bucket. She was getting fresh air. At this point, Father Burke arrived at the stairs, opened the front gate, and turned and closed it. I was now at the full length of the cord. I do think manufacturers of plastic buckets should make their handles stronger. Somehow, the handle, I didn't even hear the sound of the handle snapping, but away went the bucket and it struck Father Burke at the base of the skull, and he pitched forward on the gravel, apparently insensible, his hair in disarray. I looked down at the figure, I thought, it's Burke and Hare all over again. He's dead. I pulled him to his feet, put him in the car, and I took him home. Well, that was in a terrible state. I mean, my wife would be excommunicated or something. So I said, we must have him to tea. That's the only thing. We'd ask him to tea. If he partakes of our tea, then you'll be all right. Because there's an old saying, he who breaks my bread sings my song. So she rang him up and said, would he come to tea? And he said he'd come and visit, but he wouldn't stay to tea. Horror, I thought. He's going to be excommunicated. It's awful, or something. All my fault. What have I done? I said, I'll tempt him. I'll make him something that he's never tasted before. Something really delicious, like genuine maids of honour. And I will make it. So immediately, got out the recipe, rolled out the pastry, you know, puff pastry, damn thing, lumps of butter, another layer. Then you've got to cool it, shove it in the fridge for half an hour, fridge broken, onto the roof of the car, onto the roof rack, drive round the village grid, back again, pick all the dirts and pigeon feathers and stuff out of it, roll it, more dabs of butter, fold, roll it, must always roll the same way, stick little plastic arrows in, little cellophane red arrows that you know, roll out, on the roof of the car, round the green, back again, pick all the dirt off, roll it. Then I made the middle, you know, pint of milk, bit of rennet, mix in the egg yolks and the sugar, delicious. Cakes in the oven, in with a filling, rush them in. And I said to him, now when Father Burke comes, offer him the maids of honour. And if he accepts, he's eaten our bread. So then I'll put the kettle on, we do the full tea, I've got the heavy mob, you know, the Dundee cake and the rock cakes all ready. And I'll rush the whole lot in, keep him chatting and make sure he eats. And then we'll be okay because we accept our hospitality. And I waited in the kitchen, kettle boiling, all ready. Nothing. Minute after minute after minute. So I called the dog in, wrote on the back of an old envelope, what's with Father Burke and the maids of honour? What's happened? Sent the dog, fine, Mummy, off you go. Waited in desperation, came back, and there was the envelope, took it out, and there it was, written on the back of this envelope. He said, H2 brew tea.
Never a dull moment in Frank's village. And now we go on to Dennis Norden, and if you remember, his quotation was, it never rains, but it pours.
But every week in the panel game known as My Word, or another Shakespearean quotation, that last refuge of noble minds, every week there is one round of questions about which my gorge rises about 10 points. It's the round known as Origins and Derivations. Now, I claim this round should be called Origins and Lemons. Because the answer that Jack Longland always insists are the right ones, to me, seem terribly unlikely ones, and it always gets to a point where we get very disputatious about it, as with the Romans and the Russians today. But a couple of weeks ago was when I felt it rankle most. I was asked, why was Richard I called Richard the Lionheart? And I gave what I believe to be a pretty sensible, commonsensical type of answer. I said, well, probably because he was one of the first of those transplant jobs. And surgery in those days being rather primitive, instead of using a human being, they found a dead lion and used that for spares, you know. Do you know, he looked at me as though I was some grubby little 14-year-old. It's very ingenious, you know, that laugh, he said, but wrong, I'm afraid. Let's press on to the next round. Yes. He's great on this pressing on to the next round until you actually get into a pub with him. But this rankled with me, you see, because I'd been made to look a complete nana, and I sulked about this for the whole week. Then I had a very fortuitous encounter. I went into a second-hand shop because I had trouble with the watch and I wanted a new second-hand on it. And while there, I came across a book called, and the title struck me, it was called Medieval Furgery. And I picked it up because I couldn't imagine what furgery was. And, you know, there's always the odd chance it might be dirty, you know. But when I leafed through it, I found that the F was just the old-fashioned way of writing S, and it was all about the early days of medicine and surgery. And do you know, there in black and white was the actual word-by-word, blow-by-blow description how Richard I actually did have a nasty turn in the middle of a crusade. And the Virgin had had found a dead lion, taken out the heart, and thwopped it. Richard, so my explanation actually was literally correct, you see. And this man's condescension was absolutely unforgivable. Now, you may say, yes, but it could still just be a myth or legend. Can a human being live with a lion's heart inside? Is it possible, you might say? Well, that is very interesting, because this doctor who did it had done a follow-up on Richard's case, and they found that he was able to live a perfectly normal life, except that every time he passed a piece of fresh meat, he had this irresistible urge to roar. Now, this is perfectly true, and in fact, it has lived on as a quotation, because when a visiting historian said to him, having a lion's heart in front of you, right inside you, surely that must be painful. And he said, it never pains, but it roars.
By a very, very close margin indeed, Frank Muir wins the contest of the two stories, and that means that his team of Gillis Powell and Frank Muir win the entire contest by exactly half a mark, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Gillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC.